another episode of the Seamless Connection podcast. I have with me today Dr. Stephanie Mueller, and I'm so thrilled to speak with her about all things telehealth, interhospital transfer, and associated impacts to cost of care, length of stay, and clinical outcomes for patients. So, Dr. Mueller, it's such a pleasure to have you on today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know you've been doing a lot of work in a number of different areas, but before we dive into that, I want to introduce you to the audience more formally. Can you give us a little bit of background on yourself in terms of both where you are today, but also what brought you there in terms of your interest in healthcare and your specific role today?
Oh, sure. Yes. I feel like I could talk for an hour on this. So I currently work as a clinician investigator, which is, somebody who does both clinical work and research within the Division of General Internal Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. I spend about 25 or 30% of my time doing clinical care, taking care of hospitalized patients. And then I spend about 50 to 60% of my time doing research on broadly on healthcare transitions within the hospital setting, but primarily focused on interhospital transfers, which is where my research is focused and where my grants are focused. And then I spend another 25% of my time doing some faculty development leadership things within our Department of Medicine. What brought me into healthcare in general is a long story that dates back probably to my childhood. I was introduced to healthcare because both of my parents are physicians. And I always loved sort of healthcare, and I loved math and science. And so it just felt like a natural fit for me to sort of follow in their footsteps and go into medicine, although my area of medicine that I practice is different than both of my parents. I was drawn to practice hospital medicine because I loved taking care of acutely sick patients that were in the hospital, both in terms of the sort of emotional connection that I was able to have with these patients when they're sort of in that vulnerable state being sick in the hospital, as well as sort of the mental stimulation that I got from the diagnostic problem solving and trying to figure out what was wrong and sort of both doing that sort of diagnostic workup and then therapeutic plan to help them to get better. And then I got interested in pursuing research in improving care transitions in the hospital, primarily because of the vulnerabilities that I saw as a clinician taking care of patients during these care transitions, and in particular with interhospital transfer, as patients are quite sick when they're transferred between acute care hospitals. And so they're very vulnerable to this discontinuity of care. And so I was really inspired by that as a clinician. And then I also, I think, had that mental sort of stimulation interest in evaluating the problems with that transfer process and problem solving to try to figure out how to make that better. Sort of the same, I think, background that drew me to hospital medicine as a clinician drew me to studying interhospital transfer as a researcher.
No, that's fantastic. One of the things that's interesting from your specific viewpoint is that you're actually sitting where the patients come. You're not the one typically transferring patients out. You're usually accepting those transfers. Mm-hmm. What did you notice, and what kind of triggered that kind of thought process of there's a problem here, or, this is a bigger scale than it should be potentially, right? And I think you've written a lot of papers both ways, but how does that viewpoint kind of change it from it? Because we usually hear from the acute care hospitals transferring patients into a place like yours,
right?
Because they all lose their patients. But I'm curious what the problem and the viewpoint is from your end at the receiving end.
Yeah. So most of my sort of early experience with that came from the viewpoint is during my residency, right? That's when you're spending 80 hours in the hospital a week during those 3 years of residency. And I have to say, what I'm going to talk about, I think a lot, it's the practice of interhospital transfer has come a long way. Besides the work that I've been doing, just sort of operational improvements in the quality of care that we provide to hospitalized patients has come a long way since my residency. Mm-hmm. But there was a term that we had as residents, and, there's clips of this, I think, across residency programs, where outside hospital transfer patients were called OSH bombs. OSH was outside hospital. And the reason for that term came from the fact that oftentimes these patients were extremely sick. they would come in the late evening or overnight hours, because that's when the beds would open up at the tertiary or quaternary care hospital. We would have no advanced notification that this patient was arriving. So we would know because the nurse would page us and say, this patient has arrived from, you know, this other hospital, please come and put in admission orders. And we would have no information about the patient, or they might have some scant, paper charts that sort of came along with the patient. As you can imagine, it was an extremely vulnerable process for patients. And I think, you know, clinicians did the best they could on both sides of the thing. I think on both sides of the transfer, that both the transferring clinicians were trying to do their best by the patient, right? Transferring them to a facility where they could receive the care they needed. And the clinicians on the receiving side were, you know, trying to do their best. I think the system wasn't set up to really adequately care for patients in a high quality, safe way. I think having electronic health records and everything has sort of moved things along with some of the health information exchange piece of things, which is some of my research is working to further improve that. And just the way that we communicate in general and sort of value communication within the hospital, I think has also come a long way since that time. But also one of the areas that I'm trying to improve upon along with many others within that field.
So when the patients came in, they're referred to as the Osh bombs, mm-hmm. then, you know, obviously it sets kind of throws a wrench in your schedule, right? In terms of as the receiving physician, if you don't know the patient's there, you can't prep, you don't necessarily have the tests and everything lined up and ready to go in terms of answers of what is the treatment plan, what are they sending them there for, all of that. So, and I know you've done a lot of research on this. What did you find as patients were being transferred in terms of outcomes? You know, whether it's length of stay, cost of care, actual clinical outcomes, you know, were they discharged the same day or within 24 hours, or they actually need it and stayed for a week or, you know, many days longer that justified that kind of trauma of that transfer?
Yeah. Well, I'd say there's a lot of variability, right, in the outcomes and in some of those outcomes that you were asking about. So probably the biggest study that I looked at addressing that question was using Medicare data. So we looked at, Medicare patients that had undergone inter-hospital transfer. And we did our analyses such that we kind of stratified our results by disease process. Mm-hmm. And we compared patients who had undergone transfer for that disease process compared to non-transferred patients and used some sort of various statistical techniques to make them more like each other, because as you can imagine, patients that undergo transfer are very different than patients that don't. So we use sort of a propensity matching technique to try to make those two kind of the exposed and the control group more similar. And what we found was that kind of across all diagnoses, all patients had longer length of stay and higher hospital costs, which are very correlated. The longer you stay in the hospital, the more expensive it is. And were more likely to be discharged to a subacute care facility as compared to being discharged directly home. And we looked at some other mortality outcomes for these patients, both 3 and 30-day mortality. And we found that among patients with select diagnoses, transfer was associated with a lower adjusted odds of both 3 and 30-day mortality, where among patients with some other select diagnoses, transfer was associated with a greater adjusted odds of both 3 and 30-day mortality. So kind of our hypothesis related to those findings is that transfer might be beneficial for some select patients with some diagnoses and impose more risk or more harm for some other patients with some other diagnoses. And some of this might be related to the processes with which we transfer patients, because the patients that were associated with improved mortality outcomes were those that happened to have more streamlined kind of algorithms or guidelines in place for when to transfer patients, like patients with acute myocardial infarction, where there is pretty clear guidelines and door to balloon time, and hospitals are kind of set up to accommodate those patients and provide them and or transfer them to get them that care that they need in a timely manner. So
versus what were the ones, the clinical reasons for transfer or the equivalent kind of terminology that didn't do so well with that 30-day and 3-day mortality? Would you remember any of those?
So we looked at the top 15 diagnoses in terms of prevalence at time of transfer. And that's where those were the top 15 diagnoses that we looked at. And so we essentially found mortality benefit among patients with, these sort of streamlined diagnoses such as acute myocardial infarction, respiratory disease, which a lot of those included vented patients or ICU transfers, sepsis, and stroke. And then some of the patients that were associated with greater mortality were things that were a little bit less sort of guideline driven in terms of their management and transfer processes. So things like patients with urinary tract infections and hip fractures, interestingly, and pneumonia and metabolic diseases, which sort of incorporate a bunch of various things like diabetes or DKA related complications. So there was kind of a whole milieu of patient diagnoses that were associated with worse outcomes.
Which makes sense. And one of the articles you've written about extensively is, and one of the points you've written about extensively is that the general perception for many people is that transfers are driven by the patient needing a procedure. And one of the studies you did actually showed that actually, 30 to 90% of patients, depending on what that diagnosis was, don't actually get a procedure when they get to that the final tertiary care center or quaternary care center. So, and I know that was a few years ago. I don't know if anything has changed since then, but I would love to kind of get your thoughts on that, which is that's actually against prevailing wisdom and actually begs the reason that like, why are people transferring, right, when there is no
right. Right. So, with that study, I think you highlight the fact that there's probably some subset of patients that undergo transfer that don't actually need transfer. Mm-hmm. Now, it's important to keep in mind a couple of things, a couple of caveats related to that study that I did. So one, we were only looking at procedural outcomes. Mm-hmm. Certainly patients need a higher level of care that don't incorporate that procedural aspect, such as, specialty consultant services or something to that effect, which we did not capture with our study. And then the other thing is you're going to want to have probably some element of a false negative rate, right? If we're thinking about transfers, we want to have it be a little bit to err on the side of sensitivity versus specificity, meaning that we want to accept patients that might need these specialty procedural care at the expense of maybe having some that don't actually need that, rather than missing patients that do actually need that care and don't undergo transfer. Where that sensitivity specificity falls, we don't really know, right, in terms of what our ideal rate should be. But I think it's safe to say that there are certainly a subset of patients that undergo this kind of risk-ridden care transition, right? They're sick patients, they're undergoing transfer. So we're putting these patients at risk of that discontinuity of care. And there's some subset that probably don't actually need that transfer. And particularly in this day and age, I think there's been a lot of progress with the types of care that we provide to patients, and particularly not necessarily requiring the patient to be physically in front of us to be able to provide that care. And so I think we just are a little bit lagging behind and trying to identify which patients, might not benefit from that physical transfer. And we could provide these patients with some alternative to that physical transfer that might be more beneficial for them.
No, that completely makes sense. And when we think about the cost of a inner hospital transfer, obviously there's a dollars and cents cost, but there's a clinical outcome cost. How would you explain that to our audience in terms of, some might say, hey, listen, it's the same hospital system. At the end of the day, the dollars are all consolidated. Does it really matter? Right. And then there's the other view, which says, hey, 5,000 transfers, inner hospital transfers, even within the same system is still too many. Can you explain why is this a problem?
Oh, I think there's a lot of outcomes and a lot of perspectives we can look at it in terms of the sort of cost burden of transfers. So I think, you know, certainly there's the dollar and cents cost that we talked about. We know that these patients generally have longer length of stay, which increases hospital costs, which is just, if it's unnecessary, that's bad for our healthcare system. Patients are transferred sometimes between, you know, between healthcare systems. Most more and more frequently, they're being transferred within a healthcare system as these healthcare systems are growing. But that still does happen. And there's the cost to the patient and the family of being potentially farther away from loved ones who can come visit them in the hospital, or if the family does want to come visit them in the hospital, often has to then pay for transportation and pay for lodging to be nearby. There's the cost to just our healthcare system in the sense of taking up these tertiary and quaternary care beds, which, as we know, there's a, you know, particularly since COVID, there's been a capacity crunch at all these hospitals. And so if we're taking up these hospital beds sort of with these transfers and these patients don't actually need the care at these hospitals, they're taking those that resource away from, you know, maybe a patient who then has to wait in the ER for boarding for 2 days. And we know that ER boarding is associated with worse patient outcomes. So there is sort of these other consequences to other patients, to the healthcare system, you know, to clinicians that are going through, you know, managing and doing all the work related to transferring and accepting patients. And if that's an unnecessary workload, that patient doesn't actually need that. So there's a lot of different stakeholders that are influenced by this process.
Completely. And when you think about one thing that I found interesting when you and I were chatting earlier was that the command center, if you will, the transfer center wasn't actually established till the mid-teens of the 2000s. So, which I think a lot of people would find surprising. I know I did when you shared that. So when you were talking earlier about the process is not refined and formalized and institutionalized, or it hasn't been, you know, till more recently for many places. I think a lot of people would be surprised by that because transfers have been happening since the beginning, right? So
yeah. How
did hospitals do it before, and what are they working towards now based on kind of learnings over the last 5-10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think with kind of similar to any type of process of care, it's been an evolution, right? So there was some data that came out about hospital transfers back in the 80s, but that was primarily related to the patient dumping phenomenon that was happening with, you know, un or underinsured patients presenting to ERs, and they would get shipped off to another ER or to like the city, you know, hospital. And that was the sort of reasoning behind the inaction of the EMTALA laws, where you know, if patients have to be cared for at a facility that is able to care for them. And so it essentially outlawed patient dumping. If a patient showed up like bleeding on your doorstep, you couldn't ship them off because of insurance. And then there'd been some smattering of data out there about sort of effective transfer for patients with select diagnoses. So with things like acute myocardial infarction or the safe physical transfer of ICU patients that need to be transferred on a ventilator and sort of what type of staffing and ambulance and everything you need. And, but, you know, I think, you know, so there was sort of a more rudimentary system, I think, in terms of accepting patients for transfer and the processes that sort of went along with that. And I think as our like electronic health records and other things have evolved, I think that's added to the ability to streamline these processes a bit more, because there's sort of an easier sort of central location where people can, you know, gather kind of clinical information or reach like an individual to coordinate that transfer. So as you mentioned, we in our hospital at Brigham and Women's kind of created our access center. I believe it was in 2017, but I can double check that date. And it was really to streamline the access for patients to get into the hospital from a variety of sources. So there used to be sort of, you know, any patient that came through the ER, they had their own process of getting admitted, you know, to the hospital. Patients that were getting directly admitted to clinic from clinic had their own method, and then patients who had to be, you know, that were undergoing intra-hospital transfer from another acute care hospital had their own sort of method of kind of entering our hospital system. And so by consolidating that within the access center, it sort of generated an ability to sort of streamline bed availability and prioritization for patients that were entering the hospital from all these disparate care settings. And even since then, it's now evolved where this past fall, so I believe it was in October of 2023, our access center essentially merged with Mass General's access center, because we are, you know, the Mass General Brigham healthcare system. So now there's the Mass General Brigham, they call it the PTAC, the Patient Transfer Access Center. And so that is a consolidated essentially access center across the Mass General Brigham system, which includes Brigham and Women's and Mass General Hospital as sort of the quaternary care hospitals, as well as all the community hospitals that are within the Mass General Brigham system. So if we're getting a call about a patient transfer, they can sort of see what care needs that patient has, as well as what capacity all these hospitals have to see sort of where within the system they might fit the best.
And that sounds a lot more sophisticated than some of the hospitals we have worked with or that we have heard about, in terms of where there's still doctors trying to call their friend at the regional academic medical center to see if they can take a patient, right? That still happens mm-hmm. today, which is yeah. interesting that wide spectrum of yeah. kind of the workflow of transferring a patient.
Yeah, and I think having that sort of centralized access also helps to reduce the potential for error. Mm-hmm. So I actually wrote a commentary on, a web M&M case that the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality had sent me and asked me to comment on. And it was that scenario where, an individual clinician at a community hospital called a colleague that they knew at the tertiary care facility to coordinate the transfer of the patient. And it turns out the patient was mistriaged. They were sicker than what was able to sort of be managed on the regular medical floor. And so the patient arrived sort of quickly, needed to have an escalation of care to go to the intensive care unit. And so that sort of leads to a potential, unsafe practice, right? Where when you have sort of the access center, it's more trained clinicians, it's staffed by nurses who have a process with which to evaluate sort of the stability of the patient and make sure that the patient is being appropriately triaged to sort of the level of care that they need.
And I've always been curious about this, because that is an example of when the transfer center is triaging for an accepted transfer. Mm-hmm. How often does it happen that they reject a transfer, and under what circumstances does that happen, if at all?
Yeah. So I don't have any data to share about rejected transfers, although it probably exists somewhere. I'll have to do a lit search on that. Yeah. But I can tell you that we do sometimes, deny patient transfers. It's usually, anecdotally, in the context of if the patient really does not require a tertiary or quaternary care need. Which often comes most often if it's a patient or family request for transfer, rather than the clinician mm-hmm. thinking that they, require that transfer. And so oftentimes if we don't feel like the patient has that sort of quaternary care need, and also we're limited by capacity, then, we might decline a transfer. I believe we usually try to offer some alternatives, such as a follow-up in our outpatient clinic, if that's mm-hmm. something that, if pertinent to the clinical case. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
No, I've always wondered about that, because you can't be accepting 100% of transfers for the capacity right. reasons we talked about. But I'm always curious about, mm-hmm. when and how is that decision made on yeah. the rejection of the transfers. And then one other question, as we're talking about inter-hospital transfers, that are necessary versus unnecessary. I know you're working on the New Point study. Yep. If you share with us a little bit about what and how you're looking at the concept of an unnecessary transfer, and actually how you define it to begin with, because I know there's a wide variety of definitions that people think about when they say unnecessary transfer.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, this is the, you know, the primary focus of this R01 study that's funded by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. And I'm, you know, the principal investigator for this study. So this is our primary focus, is to try to determine where that cut point is, right? So which patients actually might benefit from transfer and which ones are potentially unnecessary or potentially inappropriate is sort of the terminology that we use is for the title of the study. And so the question that you ask in terms of how do we define potentially inappropriate is it an excellent one. And that was sort of the whole first aim of our study is we conducted a number of focus groups. So we're partnering with actually 18 hospitals across the country that are involved in this study. And in the first aim of the study, we had various stakeholders that participated within these focus groups from all these various sites. And the stakeholders included, you know, transferring clinicians, accepting and admitting clinicians, hospital leadership that manages kind of hospital transfers. And then we have a patient family advisory council to bring in the patient family perspective. And we sort of conducted these focus groups with guided discussions and with clinical cases to talk through various scenarios of patient transfer to try to get at that question of, well, from all these stakeholders, because each of these individuals have, you know, an important perspective to include in our definition. So from all these stakeholder perspectives, what defines a potentially inappropriate transfer? And so we did come up with essentially a consensus definition or sort of group of, you know, criteria with which we now have converted into an adjudication tool. And so the next phase of the study, which is just getting started, is all of these 18 hospitals are going to be doing targeted chart review on 100 patients who have undergone transfer to mm-hmm. their hospital. So in total, we'll have 1,800 patient transfers from across 18 hospitals across the country. And we'll be determining amongst all of those 1,800 patients whether or not those transfers were deemed inappropriate or appropriate. And therefore, we'll get the overall kind of prevalence of potentially inappropriate transfers. So our guidelines for defining potentially inappropriate was from a patient safety lens, because that was sort of the goal of perspective that we wanted to include. And so essentially, the consensus definition that we came up with was patients, a potentially inappropriate transfer is a transfer where a patient either does not require this type of unique care need that the accepting hospital is providing, or they don't require it in an urgent manner, right? So there's sort of a two-step thing where they either have a care need that doesn't actually require the capabilities of the potential accepting hospital, or they might require that care, but it doesn't need to be within the time constraints of that hospitalization. So it could have, you know, could be deferred to at the outpatient setting or at some point down the road. And so those were sort of the two criteria that we came up with. And we have some other sort of elements that go along with that that are included in our chart review tool that each of our sites are using. But yeah.
No, that's fantastic. And when do you expect the results from the study?
Well, so we're just getting started on the adjudications now. There's a lot of, you know, administrative red tape to get through and IRB approvals, and we had to do adjudicator training to make sure that we're all doing using the tool in a reliable way. And so we have, I think, 10 of our 18 sites launched at this point just getting started with these adjudications. We anticipate it will take about a year for the sites to conduct all these chart reviews. Because, a little less than a year, we're aiming for 10 charts per month. Because these are people that are busy clinicians that are balancing doing these chart reviews with their other day-to-day work. Probably a year, a little bit more till we have that data crunched to be able to present and share.
No, I'm very much looking forward to it. Obviously, we have a vested interest in understanding what's going on with hospital transfers and, you know, what are unnecessary, why are they happening if they're unnecessary, and bringing that education forward, which I think is what you've been working on for many years now.
Yeah, we're excited. It's really exciting work. We have a conference coming up next week, and sort of everybody that's involved in the study, we're going to meet up and do a sort of a retreat at the start of the conference to just get together and, you know, be able to be with each other in person, because we're all spread all over the country. So, so it's really exciting work. We're all very excited about it.
That is very cool. It is rare that everyone can get together at the same time, especially if you're across different regions, different specialties, different administrations. So I'm looking forward to hearing how that conversation and the results of the new study go. And thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today in terms of following up on what is driving hospital transfers, what is the cost of a hospital transfer that's done, you know, potentially inappropriately, what are the appropriate diagnoses for that. The one area we didn't touch on that I did want to pick your brain on a little bit, it's, you know, peripheral to this, is one of the things you said earlier, it was like, you don't need to be in front of the person, the patient physically anymore, right? To potentially deliver that care, or that care that they're being transferred for, that knowledge they're being transferred for. Obviously, and that begs the question, telehealth, right? So in terms of how much can telehealth help impact the volume of unnecessary transfers, potentially unnecessary transfers happening. What's your experience been in there? What do you think, where do you think we are today versus what do you think the potential is to do more?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest untapped resources that we have that could really change the landscape in terms of caring for patients as an alternative to transfer. You know, telehealth has come such a long way. And I think particularly with COVID, it really has launched telehealth into sort of the forefront of everybody's minds. And, you know, we're using it in so many realms now. And I think when we think about telehealth, it's also a very variable offering, right? So telehealth, I think, is a blanket term that can encompass many different aspects of care. And so this came up with our kind of aim one and our kind of preliminary review and coming up with the definition of inappropriate transfers is, you know, would the patient be appropriately served by some potential alternatives to transfer? And some of the themes that came up with our qualitative analysis was, in terms of these alternatives to transfer, were things like telehealth, but telehealth broken down into engagement with a known specialist that's outside the hospital, you know, just by telephone or by Zoom or something similar, and a teleconsult, right? If you need the actual expertise of a cognitive specialist, like an infectious disease doctor or nephrologist or something like that, you know, and or teleconsult of a procedural specialist to really make the determination as to whether or not a procedure is required, which would then require the physical transfer of the patient. And so I think that, and what was interesting in what came out of our focus groups was that these were all considered as, you know, potential alternatives to transfer. But oftentimes they're considered in two different ways. So one is the theoretical alternative to transfer. So could this patient theoretically have been served appropriately with this teleconsult instead of a physical transfer instead of the physical transfer of the patient? The answer to that might be yes. But in the other realm is the realistic perspective. And so we ask actually both of those questions with our chart review tool. Could this patient have been appropriately served by any of these alternatives to transfer, including telehealth and several others? You know, theoretically, under ideal circumstances, could they have been served by any of this? And then if you answer yes to any of that, then the follow-up question is, in your current systems of care, could this patient have been appropriately served by any of these alternatives to transfer? And so I think it's going to be very interesting to see where the answer to the former question is yes, and the answer to the latter question is no, because that shows a gap, right? If we, in theory, could provide this care, and this patient could have, you know, been appropriately served with this alternative to transfer. But in our current system, we don't actually have that capability. That's a gap in the care that we're able to provide.
Right. And then the next research study is laid out for you as to what's
exactly.
That's fantastic. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. This has been such a lovely conversation and really food for thought in terms of what we're doing in our systems and why and where the next steps take us. So thank you again.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This has been great.